This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
The idea in the 70s was that it would really serve the needs of the whole community. And over the decades, that vision stayed true, although the ownership and management and sort of leadership of each of those functions became separated. And so it was really during this renovation process that it kind of forced all of these community partners and the school to get back on the same page.
Welcome to Building Reuse is Climate Action, a Tangible Remnants limited series proudly sponsored by Quinn Evans. I'm Nikita Reed, an architect and preservationist who specializes in sustainable design. Many of you know me as the host of the Tangible Remnants podcast, where I demystify the adaptive reuse process for building owners and developers. Beyond the podcast, I'm also an associate principal at Quinn Evans, where I help to bring adaptive reuse projects to life. This limited series will highlight one successful adaptive reuse project per episode, and will feature key players involved in the project team from both the design side and the owner side of the project. This series is going to pull back the curtain and do a deep dive into each project to discuss how a project went from conception to completion, the lessons learned along the way, and how the building is positively impacting the community today. Today's episode is all about the Marie Reed Community Learning Center in Washington, D.C. This project was a 150,000 square foot renovation of a 1978 building. During this episode, I'm joined by my Quinn Evans colleague, Tracy Huckle, who served as one of the project architects on the job, as well as Katie Lundgren, who was the principal of the school during the renovation and throughout the end of the 2025 school year. There are many gems throughout this episode, particularly around community engagement, designing for security between mixed uses, and ways to commemorate a site's legacy. The building is located in the Adams Morgan neighborhood of Washington, D.C. And here's a quick historical sidebar from the school's website that talks about how the neighborhood got its name. From the 1890s through the 1950s, Washington, D.C. was an extremely segregated city. In 1891, Wilson Elementary School, which was located at 2428 17th Street Northwest, was built to serve African American children. In 1901, the Morgan School, which was located at 18th Street and California Street Northwest, was built to serve the white children. Fast forward to 1930, and the Morgan School building had begun to deteriorate. So the city built a new school, Adams, for the white students. As so often happens, after Adams was built, the African-American students at Wilson were sent to the Morgan School, which was still in poor condition. And when the Morgan School became overcrowded, the old Wilson School was used as an annex. It's from these two segregated schools, Adams and Morgan, that the Adams-Morgan neighborhood obtained its name. Fast forward to 1954, when the Supreme Court called for the end of school segregation with Brown versus the Board of Education. In that same year, there was an incident between students at the Adams School and students at the Morgan School, which left a student injured and resulted in the formation of various community associations, including the Adams-Morgan Community Council. And this council included both white and black residents who sought to create a truly integrated school and provide a quality education for their children. The council began to consider creating a community school in which the school would not only serve as a place of learning for children, but would also offer adult education courses and provide a recreation center for the area residents. And so due to the efforts of the council and the individuals such as Bishop Marie H. Reed and Edward Jackson, the Morgan School became the Morgan Community School in 1967. To accommodate the community's vision, the architectural firm of Fry and Welsh designed a new school on a 3-acre site that spanned across both sides of Champlain Street. And the name of the school was changed to honor the person who first envisioned the community school. And so the new Marie H. Reed Community Learning Center was dedicated in May of 1978. Nearly 40 years later, Quinn Evans was hired to do a renovation and adaptive reuse of the entire complex. So in addition to the elementary school, the center also accommodates several community partners, including a public health clinic, child care center, women's health clinic, and community swimming pool. Every space within the facility was renovated and transformed through this ambitious modernization, which carefully addressed the needs of both the school and the community. The renovation was truly a transformation that reflects a vibrant celebration of education, wellness, diversity, culture, and community. The completed project went on to receive the Green Schools Award from the National Capital Region of the United States Green Building Council. It also received a citation in institutional architecture from the Potomac Valley chapter of the American Institute of Architects, and it achieved LEED Gold certification. Be sure to check out this episode's show notes for resources. And while you're in the show notes, also be sure to sign up for our newsletter so you can get tips right to your inbox. You'll hear more about Quinn Evans later in the episode, but for now, let's jump into the project. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation about the Marie Reed Community Learning Center between me, Tracy Huckle, and Katie Lundgren. Well, Katie, let's start with your involvement in the project. Back when you became principal in 2014, what was the building like when you joined the school?
Well, it was a very unique building. I came to learn that it's called Brutalist style architecture. It was an open space, open concept school building. So what that meant in reality is that there were no walls for any classrooms. There was this really dingy dark green carpet that covered the floors throughout the whole building on all levels. There were lots of dark ramps internally and very narrow slit windows that let in very little natural light. And just programmatically, that meant that our classrooms were developed using these partitions on wheels. So teachers would kind of wheel these partial walls around to create some privacy for their classroom. But each classroom space had no doors. It was very easy to overhear what was going on in other learning spaces just on the other side of the partitions. So it was a very, very unique learning environment when I came in 2014.
Was this your first experience working on a renovation of a school project?
Prior to becoming a principal, I was an assistant principal with DC Public Schools at a different school site, a middle school, where we were engaged in like a partial renovation that happened in stages. So I was part of the school improvement team, the SIT team for that middle school project as an assistant principal. But this was my first time as the principal of a school, really spearheading my community's involvement in this wholesale renovation.
Gotcha. And Tracy, when did you get involved in the project?
I joined the project after they had decided that they were going to move forward with renovating the existing building. prior to me starting, there was a little back and forth of whether or not they were going to demolish the entire building and rebuild, or if they were going to keep the existing building and move forward. I was brought in on a time where I focused a lot on the interior development of the school and how the spaces would be organized within the existing building.
Yeah, and hearing Katie talking about the existing conditions of the school of Wheeling wall partitions, I can imagine that there was a lot of acoustical considerations and design considerations that had to be considered throughout this project. How was the design team able to handle the acoustic separation without creating a feeling of isolation? Because it seemed like having more of a communal feeling was really important to the school and the community.
Exactly, Nikita. One of the key considerations and characteristics of the school was this very large sense of community, and having teachers within an entire grade really come together and teach together. And so we wanted to make sure, even though we were separating them into individual classrooms, that we really promoted this idea of community and created areas where multiple classrooms could come together and teach as a group. So we did make sure that each of the individual classrooms had proper acoustic separation so that they could have a more quiet, isolated kind of classroom environment. But then they were all grouped around these larger gathering zones that promoted community, promoted multiple teaching, multiple classrooms kind of coming together into one communal space.
And Katie, knowing that the elementary school is part of the learning center, talk to us a little bit about separation between the elementary school and the various stakeholders and spaces that make up the learning center came about. And what was it like navigating some of that decision-making process?
That was a really unique aspect of our school and this project as a whole. Since the Marie Reed Community Learning Center, when it was originally built in the 70s, it was really envisioned as this community hub. So there is a health clinic on site, a recreation center, a center for women, infants, and children, a daycare for lower income families. And so the idea in the 70s was that it would really serve the needs of the whole community. And over the decades, that vision stayed true, although the ownership and management and sort of leadership of each of those functions became separated. And so it was really during this renovation process that kind of forced all of these community partners and the school to get back on the same page when it came to our space and identifying like which parts of our building and campus need to continue to be shared and which parts need to be separated and more specified for their individual use. So that was a really important part of our school improvement team process, was making sure that there was representation from each of those groups on the SIT at the time that we were meeting with the architects and the designers and the district leaders around this project to make sure that all the different needs of those partners were included in the design. And that also required some creative like fundraising and partnerships across these different groups that I think was kind of foreign to the DCPS at the time. But one of the key things for us as a school was safety and making sure that our children and our school campus was able to be separated and secured from the public and from the other organizations that share the building space. And so there was a lot of thoughtful communication about like interior doors with key fob, locking access and which entrances and exits needed to be accessed by school personnel only versus partners. And there are still some shared spaces that the school shares with the rec center and with the pool. And so we've been able through that renovation process to be very thoughtful about, you know, how those spaces are designed to serve the needs of the community after hours, but also serve the needs of the school during hours, and all while keeping student and public safety in mind.
Yeah, I know that minimizing stranger danger and increasing the feeling of safety in schools is super important. And so, Tracy, I'm curious from a design standpoint, how did some of those security challenges show up?
We actually did go through a bit of a process of looking at different means of security measures. I believe we looked at different types of glass because we wanted to make sure that we maintained visual security, because I think that's important. The school itself was very closed off before, and part of the kind of idea of opening up the school, getting eyes on the school, is important so you can see what's going on, and also eyes out. So we needed to make sure that we did have a level of visual transparency between the community and the school. And so we did look at some different types of glass that we could use in key areas. We did take a lot of time, like Katie talked about, making sure we looked at the way that people navigate through the multiple levels, because it's a four-story building located on two different plots that are bisected by a street. So it's a very interesting building, and we just needed to make sure that the different entities were not crossing when they shouldn't. And when they should cross, we took a very intentional strategy for how the different areas connected. That connection point specifically happened between the Department of Rec and the school itself, because they did have shared spaces.
Yeah, and hearing the not only the different kind of community members that are being served, but then also the different agencies that are involved, as well as the different stakeholders. Katie, what was it like figuring out who was in charge in terms of who was making decisions on which portions of the building to keep the project going forward?
Yeah, that was pretty tricky for us. Also for me as a new principal, navigating my role in all of that, because of course I am the leader of the school portion only, but I was a critical piece to the partnerships with the other organizations in the building that were still very new to me. So I know when I came in as principal, there were already a few teachers and a community member or two who had been tapped by the previous principal to serve on the SIT. And then as I was getting up to speed, there was a project manager who helped me kind of navigate which partners needed to have a seat at the table. And I then reached out to those organizations with the help of some of my staff that had been here for earlier years, just to make sure that we had representation at all of those SIT meetings. And I think as in any project, you know, the organizations and the individuals who consistently attended those SIT meetings had more influence over the final decisions about the design and the scope and all of that. So, you know, some of our building partners were more present than others in that whole process. And I think the result of that shows in the final product too, because like our health clinic, for instance, was very present through all of that. And they were able to really make sure that their internal space met the needs of their clinic, which was really unique, you know, and separate from what would typically be included in an elementary school redesign.
Gotcha. And then Tracy, from a design standpoint, how was it working with the different stakeholders for the different spaces outside of the school building? And what was that like?
I mean, being able to engage with the community at kind of a broader scale is always exciting, because you know that what you're producing is benefiting the community at large. So these areas, you know, WIC and Community of Hope and the UPO, which is the early childhood, all of these entities are beneficial to the community around it. So it was not only important for the community partners themselves, but it was important for the community at large. So you took everything that they were talking about very seriously, because you understood that they provided a greater service to the overall Adams Morgan neighborhood. And also the Department of Rec, the community center, was loved by a lot of people. Like that pool that they had there, people came from far away in the district to come and use that pool. So we understood how sacred that space was for them. And we were in understanding how important the community is and how important these spaces are to the community and the larger DC community just made it even more important and special to be able to work one-on-one with the engagement group.
Yeah. And that is a segue for us to talk about how the community has been responding to the building. Katie, what are you hearing from the community?
Well, our campus is very large, not only the building itself, but the outside campus as well. We have a huge soccer field and basketball court, two playgrounds that serve different age ranges. There's a huge, very open plaza with seating and trees, some beautiful artwork that's outside installed. So we really see our whole campus enjoyed by the community on a regular basis, really 24 hours a day. For better or worse, being right here on 18th Street in the heart of Adams Morgan, there's a lot of evening activity on our plaza and on the playgrounds and on the field. There are a lot of, adult sport leagues that play on the outside parts of our campus, as well as all of the people that use the partner organizations that Tracy mentioned. So we have, I think, really thrived in this new phase of our school and our community learning center in the way that it's really reaching so many members of the community. I think one other thing to mention too is in the renovation and remodeling of our school, Marie Reed Elementary School, as its own, has really received increased visibility and interest from the families in the neighborhood. As Tracy mentioned earlier, in the earlier phase of before the modernization, the school did not look like a school from the street. It did not, have a welcoming appearance or just an immediate recognition as a place of learning. And through the modernization and the huge upgrade, now we're seen and families see our school and want to send their children here. So I think there's been a lot of ways that the renovation has supported so many different aspects of the community here.
Let's take a quick break so you can learn more about the sponsor of this limited series, Quinn Evans. Quinn Evans is a design firm committed to stewardship and the transformation of places that serve and inspire communities. As the proud recipient of the American Institute of Architects 2024 Architecture Firm Award, Quinn Evans is driven by the belief in the power of design to sustain, renew, and reimagine the built environment. Through partnerships with public institutions, nonprofits, and private organizations, Quinn Evans delivers thoughtful design that connects people and leaves a lasting impact. Discover more at quinnevans.com. That's www.quinnevans.com. And now back to the show.
It's very true that, especially from an outside perspective, so if you don't go into the school at all, there was such a big impact on the community just from the outside transformation. Before the school started, it seemed kind of desolate, like a place you didn't want to go to. You didn't want to sit on the park bench out front of the school. But by the school was very closed. It was a fortress, really. And by opening it up, by providing that glass, that openness, it really kind of reached out and welcomed the community. So now as you walk along 18th Street, you are really pulled into the site. There's this large kind of LED sign that lights up at night in multiple colors that says Marie Reed Community Learning Center. There is a sculptural promenade that takes you down ramps all the way down two stories to the ball field below. So we really tried to engage the community to bring them on site. And it's a night and day transformation before and after, especially just from the roadside itself.
I know a lot of the heart of the community and a lot of the creation of the school really was to be a multicultural and diverse, vibrant community. How have you seen the demographic shift through this transformation of the building?
Yeah, so I mean, we saw a pretty dramatic shift right away. And then that has been sort of sustained over the last 8 years or so since the initial closing of the old building. So when I entered as the principal in 2014, our racial demographics were pretty evenly divided between our Hispanic Latino community and our African American population. And although we've always had some other international diversity being part of the embassy neighborhoods around here. We get a lot of kids from all over the world. And immediately coming back into the renovated building in 2017, we had a huge spike in our the white students that we served, which was very new for this school community. And not only white students, but families of higher economic status and higher education levels. And so there was sort of this instant change in the student body and in the greater school community that we had to navigate, because with this beautiful upgrade and beautiful new welcoming space that maybe families had not even noticed before as a school, there was some perception within the community that this is a brand new school, and there's a lot of energy to come in and make it our own, and put programs and things in place where maybe some members of our community did not realize that we had a deep legacy of serving students and families well in the community. So there was definitely a period of a push and pull of, who is this school for, and who do we serve? Who have we served? What is our legacy, and what's our commitment going into the next generation as a school community? And we did a lot of work throughout those years to really stamp our commitment to serving all students in our community, no matter what their background. And that meant providing more resources to certain parts of our community and providing fewer resources to other parts of our community in order to make sure that everybody was able to get what they needed. So that's been an ongoing process, but we definitely saw demographic shifts that kind of matched what is also happening in the Adams Morgan and greater DC communities with gentrification and rising home prices and all of those things. And so that's just an ongoing thing that we navigate.
Yep. I'm grateful for you to talk about it that way, because I think particularly in the DC area, there is this big concern around gentrification and displacement. I'm really grateful that the work that the school is doing is to still serve the families who've been in the community and have been making up the very racially diverse background. So knowing that there is such a strong legacy and history of this school in the community, Katie, were there any conversations about how to commemorate that history within this new design project?
Yes. And it was such a perfect confluence of organizations and ideas at just the right moment. Before we were even starting the real design process, I had been contacted by a local organization called Story of Our Schools. And they were looking for schools to partner with to uncover the story and history of that school. They'd only worked in one other school at that point, and their whole program was all about helping the students of a school to learn the history and then document it in some way, in some sort of an exhibit in their school. And I, as a big history lover and, really strong believer in documenting local history, I said yes immediately. We started identifying the teacher who would spearhead this this club and the students that would do it. And then we started in that sit process of thinking about the design for the school. And as the children were doing the research to uncover the story of the Morgan School, the early Marie Reed School, there was this hope that their research would be able to be displayed in the new building. And so that came to the table at the sit team meetings. And Quinn Evans was so responsive to this idea, and they were able to incorporate this beautiful, really large 3-panel wall installment that leads from the lobby of the school to the new cafeteria. And the Story of Our Schools people worked with our school and our student club and teacher, as well as with Quinn Evans, to actually come up with the scheme for that whole thing. And then when the new building was opened, we now have this permanent museum quality exhibit of the history of the Marie Reed School, which is one of the things I'm most proud of in my 11 years here as principal. Because when I became principal here in 2014, I was dying to learn about the school. And the only thing I could find was a tiny little mention of Bishop Marie Reed and the Morgan School on this placard that was along 18th Street. And that's all I could find. And now we have this very extensive documentation of what came before as this beautiful building stretches into the future. So we're super proud of that and really grateful to all the partners that helped make it come to life.
And this legacy walk was so important, and we could feel the passion behind Principal Lundgren's desire to put this together. We really felt like having it located front and center in the school. So right as you come in and you meet that entry desk, it's just right there to the right. It's facing the community. If you're standing outside and looking through the large glass panes, you can kind of see it beyond the wall. It's also there as a connector between the school and the cafeteria, because the cafeteria is a space that the community often uses. So we wanted to make sure that this legacy, that this passion and the history of the school was in a prime and prominent location.
So I know that it was a very complex project with lots of players, lots of stakeholders and the community groups. And so I'm curious if you both could share some lessons learned on the project that you think would be helpful for someone who might be navigating a school renovation in the future. And Katie, let's start with you.
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that I'm most proud of in the way that we work together, and when I say we, I mean we at the school worked with the architects at Quinn Evans and also the folks at DGS and DC Public Schools, as well as the contractors eventually, is that we were at the table. You know, as a principal, of course, my first priority is student safety and learning. And so taking on a huge, you know, multi-year, multi-stakeholder, huge renovation project was not something I was trained to do or prepared to do or had the capacity to do, really. But I'm really proud that I and my team prioritized our deep engagement in that, because we are the sort of meeting ground for families and students in this community. And we owe it to our current and future and past community here to do it well. And so I'm most proud of the way that we really engaged our families and our teachers and our broader community in that whole process, and talked about the legacy, like the history of Marie Reed Elementary School, the history of the Morgan School, which was the school that served the African American children in our neighborhood prior to the Marie Reed School, and just really focused a lot on identifying those values and identifying those parts of our identity that we wanted to hold on to in the next phase. So as much work as it was, I'm super proud that we engaged all those different stakeholders throughout that process and really stayed really present for all of those decisions as they were being made.
Tracy, what about you? What, any lessons learned?
So some of the lessons learned that I had is that you gain so much information when you're able to engage with different types of stakeholders. We were lucky with our engagement groups that we were able to talk with each of the different entities in the school, whether it was the school itself, the Department of Rec, or any of the community partners. We are also able to talk with the teachers and have workshops with them as well, getting information from the community to understand what things were important to them, so that when we were making decisions and laying out the building, that we weren't destroying something that was extremely important to the community itself. You gain so much information from being able to interact with the teachers, the students, and the community at large. And it's just really important to be able to sit and listen to what they have to say. Because if you listen, you learn so much more. It's not just telling them, this is what you need, but listening to what they need and then manifesting that into a design solution that works for the whole community, not just the school community, but the whole community.
So in terms of community feedback, what's your favorite example that had an impact on design?
Yes. So as I mentioned earlier, the pool was a part of the community that was extremely important to the community. And it was a very tall space. I would say almost close to three stories tall. And it was this beautiful daylit space, interior pool, and it was beloved by the community. However, in the elementary school, we needed additional space. And particularly, we needed a very large space for a cafeteria. And we thought, well, this is a three-story space. Why not take the top story and give it to the cafeteria? This did not go over well with the community. They were very upset with this. They were up in arms. You cannot destroy our pool sanctuary. It is the most amazing space in the world. So we understood where they were coming from, that they had this beautiful indoor pool location. And so we took a lot of time and effort to do renderings of what the space would look like, the difference before and after, how much daylight would still be flooding into the pool space itself. And in the end, we were able to show the community that we were only taking a small portion of the overall space and that you would still have this amazing two-story daylit pool, indoor pool. And in the end, they couldn't even tell the difference. You walk in and it's still this large pool area. It's daylit. It's an amazing space. And now we have a beautiful cafeteria above it that is daylit and has views of the Capitol. So I think it was a win-win situation in the end.
Just to build on what Tracy said about listening, I remember when we were planning for these community engagement sessions, you know, many of the project leaders were English-speaking folks, and my school community was predominantly Spanish-speaking. And I remember our school having such a strong stake in the ground that if we're really going to engage our community, it has to be accessible, it has to be relatable, and able to reach all of our stakeholders. And so I was really grateful to the project leaders for hearing that, and we worked together to provide translation and interpretation of all documents that went out, all meetings that were held. They allowed me and my team to influence the format of these engagements. So instead of like rows of seats with people listening to some sage on the stage, we had round tables where there was intentionally diverse people at the tables who could translate and interpret the conversation so that all voices had an opportunity to be heard. And that, I think, was tremendously valuable during that whole process.
Oh, I love that. And I think that's such an important reminder that making sure that the information is accessible so people can actually engage with it is important to making sure that you're including everyone in the community. So being mindful of those kind of biases is super important. And so I know with any existing building, adaptive reuse project, there's always unforeseen conditions. And so I'm curious for each of you, are there any unforeseen conditions that you still remember from this project that you would like to share?
So this was a Brutalist building at that time when Brutalism was popular. Floor to ceiling heights were very small. And so we already knew that we were working with a very shallow plate of the distance between the floor to the ceiling above. But what we didn't always know was how thick some of the beams were. So we would come across some instances where we hit a beam that was a lot lower than the original documents said, and we had to find creative ways of routing our building systems because these beams were not steel beams. They were very large concrete beams. So we had to come up with interesting solutions on the fly of how to kind of route our systems throughout the buildings when one or two of these unknown larger beams popped up in the project.
Nice. Katie, what about you?
Well, it's funny to just hear Tracy's answer to that question because I would have no idea about that unforeseen condition. My mind immediately went to the restrictions of the use of space with our students and teachers. You know, once we re-entered the building, we were just overjoyed with the new space. And it was an adjustment. You know, we were used to being able to hear each other and collaborate easily and, you know, come in and out of rooms without knocking or anything like that. And so it definitely created a need for some new norm building for our staff and for our community. But I think since we were able to retain so many staff and families throughout the whole project, we were able to really modify and adapt our norms as a school culture and community, as opposed to starting brand new. But we definitely had some growing pains there in the beginning about how do we enter the cafeteria? This is in a completely different part of the building and totally different layout. How do we get, you know, 200 kids through the lunch line in an hour? Kind of working through some of those changes was a big adjustment for us.
Well, it's been so fantastic talking to both of you and learning more about the impact of this building in the community. So thank you both for joining.
Next week on the Building Reuse is Climate Action Limited series, sponsored by Quinn Evans, we head to Lansing, Michigan, to learn about the adaptive reuse of the Walter French School into affordable housing. Tune in to learn how a nonprofit structured an equity stack to pay for the renovation of this large vacant building.
You know, that was a tough conversation to value engineer things out of a project, especially for a group like the Housing Partnership. With this being the largest project to date, we wanted it all. We wanted the community to get all of what they wanted out of this project as well. And I really think Anne and her team took that to heart with what they were able to bring us.
Hey, designers and curious minds. Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex, making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good, and they have been improving, but compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.